Good morning. It's Thursday, October 6th, and you've tuned into the KRFY Morning Show with Jack and Carrie this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And it is a fall day, I would say. It's officially fall, and it's starting to feel like fall.
I have my raincoat in the car just in case, because it's kind of misting right now.
Yeah, it has been doing that, and it looks like it will continue to do so. Chance of showers and patchy fog today with a high near 56 degrees, about 40% chance of showers, but I don't know. Yeah, it does seem like you'll get something. You'll get a little wet.
Florida's going to get something.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I don't know. What's it called?
Matthew. Hurricane Matthew.
Yeah, I've just seen a little bit on the news about that. They are going to get something. Up here, we probably won't get any hurricanes, but we will get, like I said, a 40% chance of showers, mainly after noon today. Patchy fog before 9 a.m. Mostly cloudy with a high near 56. Not too windy, not too rainy, but off and on rain. Then tonight, mostly cloudy and a chance of rain later on in the night or early in the morning.
Go ahead. Trivia.
Yes.
So what's the difference between a hurricane, cyclone, and typhoon?
Well, I think a hurricane is in the Atlantic and a tropical storm is in the Pacific. I don't know what's the
cyclone. You're right. It's location. Yeah. It's location determines the name. They're all the same thing. Huh? I didn't know that.
Yeah. I didn't know that until, somewhat recently.
One of my Google searches revealed that to me.
Uh-huh. I kind of wonder why that is. Just,
I don't know.
Who knows? I guess they've been known to the people who live there longer than the people who live there knew other people in the world. Maybe. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't know if that was clearly expressed.
They created their own name and then come to find out they all meant the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, going on with our weather, we will have a small typhoon on Saturday, but then... it'll be mostly kind of rainy off and on all weekend long. It looks like highs in the mid 50s, lows at night down into the 40s. And I don't see any sign of it clearing up as we head into Columbus Day weekend, which did you know it's Columbus Day on Monday?
I forgot that.
Yeah. I didn't know until basically till I said it.
So New York City has a big parade, right? The Columbus Day Parade?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We will have a couple guests in the studio, and we have one on the telephone. Gene Girth is the instigator of 350sandpoint.org, and Helen Yost will, it looks like, be joining us as well from Wild Idaho Rising Tide. But first, I spoke just yesterday to Tom Nielsen, who will be performing a concert at DeLuna's this weekend. Let's start off with that. We'll hear a little bit from Tom himself, and then we will come back into the studio to talk with Gene and Helen more about the upcoming event and what this event will be in sponsorship of. How about that? Without further ado, here we go. Here's Tom Nielsen. Thank you very much, Tom, for joining us here on what is the KRFY Morning Show for October the 6th. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Jack. I'm doing quite well, thank you. Just got back from a hike in Old Growth Forest here north of Eugene in Oregon.
You're over in Oregon right now. Okay.
I'll be heading to Boise tomorrow and then work my way up to Sandpoint.
Yeah, I think just in case anyone's interested, you will be playing in Moscow as well on Saturday, in case we've got listeners who might be find themselves down there this weekend.
I'll be at the Unitarian Church in Moscow Saturday night and Boise Friday night. Everything is on my calendar at my website, TomNielsenMusic.com.
I'm sorry, I spoke over you there. It's TomNielsenMusic.com.
That's right.
So for those of us who have never heard of you before, what's your story? How long have you been performing?
Well, I've been performing since I was three and started playing guitar when I was 17, started writing at 17, and started recording in the 80s sometime, mid-80s, I would say. And basically, I'm just a farm boy with a guitar who likes a good ball game and human rights.
And you've got some personal history with this area as well, is that right?
Well, I used to live in northern Idaho in Lewiston. I lived in Lewiston in 74 and 75, and often think back if my wanderlust hadn't taken me away from northern Idaho, because I loved it very much there, and I'm looking forward to seeing some old friends who are scattered around in Moscow, Lewiston, Asotin, Spokane, and I hope I can fit people in. Hope they can make some of the shows, and they're planning on it.
Yeah. From 74 to 75, you said, you lived in Lewiston? And then
right. You,
I was reading through your bio, you've got how shall I put it? The list of places that you've lived is long and diverse.
Well, I got to keep moving so people can't find me, Jack. I left the country in 1970 and it opened up the world to me. And I couldn't get enough of other cultures and languages and getting acquainted with people in Africa and South America and Central America and Asia and all the different places where I've worked and lived. I was a sponge for learning about and being taught by people all around the world. And I had jobs, you know, privately with the U.S. government, with the United Nations in Somalia, that allowed me to do that. And a lot of those experiences have turned into stories in my music, and people will hear some of those on Sunday night.
Speaking of your music and what people can expect, it strikes me the heritage seems to be the Woody Guthrie and that kind of folk musician tradition. Pete Seeger, of course, that kind of guy, telling stories with a political inspiration behind them, but also just musically, it's just a guy and his guitar. I'm rambling here, but and filling in what I'd like you to say. But why don't you tell us what kind of music do you play? What can people expect from the show on Sunday night at the Lunas?
Well, they'll be hearing my own songs, with exception of one cover, maybe two, but probably just one. I am a storyteller. I do a lot of social commentary. I do a lot of satire. And mix it all together. The first set is almost all autobiographical, and the second set is actually the second set still draws on personal experiences too. Most of the show is something I have lived and done or breathed or seen or been a part of in some way, and it will address women's rights and civil rights and human rights and the environment. And social justice, and free and equal elections, and it will touch a little bit on everything. Well, not everything, because we only have a couple hours, but it will touch on a lot. There will be time for people to sing along and interact with me when I'm on stage, and as people are moved to do. And I'm looking forward to it.
Your music is political, but is it? And also it's personal. It's personal stories. I've listened to, I don't know, a dozen of your songs now. And the politics comes through in all of them. Is there are all of your songs or is that your greatest inspiration? The kind of social justice and environmental type movements, or do you play any love songs and that kind of thing?
Yeah, people are here. You know, first, personally, I think all songs are love songs. And it's in my case, it's my love for justice, my love for the environment, my love for humanity. And I don't use the handle political songwriter because I'm not sure what that means exactly, because I think everything that people choose to do has a political nature to it. And so that's why I call myself more a storyteller. And the stories that I tell are a lot about people and their situations and a lot about social justice situations. But I don't like getting tagged as political because, quite frankly, like I said, I think everything, all people's choices, what they eat, what they drink, what they wear, all those things are choices that one could say are political choices. What you choose to support, what you choose to eat, like I said. So I just call myself a storyteller, like I said, with a, who likes a good ball game and human rights. Human rights is at the center of what I do.
Going through your diverse background, you have, and speaking of kind of political era activism anyway, you were in the Peace Corps for a little while. Is that right?
I was.
Where did that take you?
At first, it took me to Colombia in 70 to 74, then to Senegal from 76, 7, and 8. Those are the two primary places. And I was doing training for Peace Corps in East Africa in 81 and 82, and then went up to Somalia with the United Nations in 83 and 84, and some other places here and there in between.
Along the way, and perhaps this is you'll tell more about this during the concert, but along the way it seems like you've had some run-ins with authority in various places around the world.
Here and there, yes. I would preface this by saying people all around the world, and this is what I've always brought back to the farm community that I grew up in. If you took all the farmers, Africa and Asia, South America, Central, Sandhill, where I grew up, put them in the same room with the same language, they would all have plenty to talk about. They would have the same things that matter, the same things that are important. And I have been treated with such great respect and dignity by people all around the world, people who are government, often stereotypes, and is very pejorative of to give us a very negative opinion of them. And authorities and the military and police are often the same around the world as well. And if someone, I have been in situations, I've been in war zones, and I have been in places where someone with a gun was going to try and take control or have authority over me. Same thing happens in this country all the time. And I have had a number of those. I have been arrested, on the one time because I was in a high conflict area, and I got out of it. And it's to travel in a way as I've traveled and to do the adventure and to find out from firsthand experience as much as I could find out about what is going on in the world. That to me has always been what moves me. Because I want to know, and I want to know firsthand for myself. I don't want to hear it from someone else. And except certainly I do get information. I think traveling as I have has helped me locate sources whose information is very similar and represents what I have experienced and observed myself. And those are the people that I go back to get more information, certainly because I can't be everywhere. But I have, I guess, I don't look at it as risks. I just look at it as part of the adventure. Sometimes when I have to extricate myself from circumstances that I wish I hadn't gotten myself into. But like I said, it's all part of the experience.
Are you allowed to perform in Canada right now? Has that situation been cleared up? I just saw a short line in your biography said that.
And all that, so the listeners can hear, I didn't get out of the States. They found my name in the computer, and they sent me over to Customs. They were going to send my truck to the warehouse and go through it. And, you know, I just told them, I can't do this. I was polite, but I was also firm that, and I didn't say this is harassment, but they knew it was harassment. And who knows what's in my file that they brought up. I hope something, or they're not doing their job. And I didn't get into Canada. I said, I don't have to go into Canada, because I was in Buffalo on my way to Detroit to do a show. And I was just going to drive through, and it was the United States authorities that would not let me into Canada. And I felt it was just harassment, and I I said, if you can't give me a reason why I need to be detained at the moment, you know, I really need to get on the road because I have commitments. And they let me go, and I went to Pennsylvania, Ohio. I went to Detroit that way.
Interesting. I guess we could talk about that for a long time. That kind of use or misuse of authority in this country. But let's bring it back home a little bit. The Standing Rock Solidarity Benefit Concert is is the story here. What is that? What's your relationship to that? Why do you feel so strongly about it?
Well, what we're seeing in Standing Rock is a microcosm of what happens around the world. The what is called eminent domain for a U.S. corporation to come in and avail themselves to someone else's land, to someone else's water, to someone else's culture, and essentially destroy it to put this pipeline through is an injustice. It's also illegal because it violates treaties. And it's something that this government does all around the world. And then people resist it, and then those people get called terrorists. Now, that's the 25 words or less of that whole dynamic. But at a basic level, in Standing Rock and Cannonball in the Dakotas, what is happening, one, it's against the law. One, it's a violation of human rights. That the security, what's called a security group of dogs, can come and attack peaceful protectors of their land and make them bleed from their flesh, spray mace or pepper spray, whatever you want to call it, in their faces. And none of those people are arrested for assaulting. Yet these same people, these protectors, are planting corn or willow trees, and they get arrested by the police. we really need to look at that. Mm-hmm. And so this creates even the greater picture of what is happening with the doomsday clock. We cannot afford the fossil fuel industry anymore. And I say that in environmental terms, because with the heating of the planet, what's already in the pipeline that's going to make us hotter, and to continue to frack and drill, look what it's doing to Louisiana. Louisiana is losing 16 square miles a year down in the bayous with all the dredging and the drilling. And we really have to examine just the impracticality is the word that's coming up, the harm that the drilling continues to do to our water supplies, to our planet. And we have to make a shift into other forms of energy. And we have to do that immediately, and we have to do it on a huge, huge scale. And like I said, and at its most basic, with the people at Standing Rock, this is an illegal action. It violates treaties, it violates culture, it violates their land, it puts them in jeopardy. When these pipelines aren't safe, these pipelines, where I live in Western Massachusetts, in Spring, city of Springfield has 1,200 leaks. I think the state of Massachusetts has, I forget how many, tens of thousands, somewhere 50 to 70,000 pipeline leaks. And
you're saying, that's interesting and surprising to me. I don't think I've heard that fact before. This is the national gas pipeline has literally thousands.
Mostly all natural gas, and I can get this information to you if you would like it. And you can, I think they can map it out. They've been trying to map it out all around the country where the leaks are. But none of these pipelines are guaranteed.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee, especially when you're going under, in this case, under the Missouri River, under the Oglala Reservoir, which was it is the water supply for that whole central section of the United States. And to in any way put that aquifer at risk is totally irresponsible. To be gracious about it with the word irresponsible. And so that's why, you know, Standing Rock is important to me. It should be, I would think, important to everyone.
Yeah. I'm going to have to start winding our conversation up here because we got to make room for our other guests this morning. So it's Tom Nielsen. He's a he is a musician and storyteller. And, well, you heard him tell you he has been called the John Stewart of folk music. Is that right?
Oh, somebody said that a long time ago. Yeah. Well, he said.
Yeah. Well, it's and now he's off the air. It's almost a dated reference now. But yeah. And also the well, anyway, he's playing at DeLuna's Cafe. It's a benefit concert. The doors open at 5:30 p.m. for an optional dinner with a show beginning at 7:30. Is it true, sir, that you were a classical violinist and also a classical vocalist as well?
I was not a classical violinist, but I was a classical vocalist. I was a tenor soloist in my youth. I performed at the Town Hall in New York City and the Cathedral Hall in Washington, D.C., National Cathedral, I mean, Washington, D.C., and Boston Symphony Hall, here and there.
My goodness. It's, well, it's quite a, what? Quite
I grew up under the tutelage of my mom, who was choir director and church organist, and she directed choirs in the community. So I was doing solos when I was three and was in adult groups when I was a kid. And I, my early leanings and a lot of teachings was classical. That's true.
Do you, now we're a little off the subject, I suppose, but do you still perform classical music at all in other times of your, I don't know, in your performing career?
Only in my solitude.
Yeah.
I do not have the voice to do what I used to do.
When you're not playing music, what do you like to listen to? Do you listen to classical or folk or something else entirely?
I listen to a lot of I listen to a lot of classical music. Hmm. Probably I've listened to classical more than any other form of music.
Interesting. How about that? Not necessarily what you'd expect. But I think we've covered just about all of it. I would also some other time like to talk to you about your friendship with Bill Lee, who he was, when I watched the Ken Burns baseball documentary, he was my favorite character who emerged out of that. But that's, again, for another time.
All right.
For now, thank you very much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your tour.
Well, thank you, Jack, and I hope to see people Sunday night.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
That is Tom Nielsen, and the song was called Four Lane Highways and Mobile Homes. Not too shabby, that Tom Nielsen. And well, we were just talking about some technical issues that we might have had, but let's move right past that and talk instead about Tom Nielsen live. No skipping, no technical difficulties to be had there. He'll be playing his acoustic guitar at DeLuna's on this Sunday on the 9th at 7:30, but with a dinner beforehand. Doors open at 5:30 for DeLuna's Dinner and a Show series. We're in the studio with Gene Girth and Helen Yost. Gene is from 350sandpoint.org. Helen is from Wild Idaho Rising Tide, or WIRT, or is that's the informal
acronym, yeah.
Yeah. And let's just ask you guys, I'm going to start with Helen. Helen, what is Wild Idaho Rising Tide?
Well, we are... Well, statewide collective, I guess I should say. We consider ourselves a radical climate activist group in that we work inside the system, but when that doesn't work, letter writings, hearings, et cetera, we have a strong history of going out and blockading things, or at least protesting them. And that's because we feel that the system is pretty much... preempted by the powers that be, who, of course, are on the side of the fossil fuel industry. And so our formal description of a mission is that we confront the root causes of climate change. And most people would agree that that is mostly the burning of fossil fuels. There's other things, of course, like deforestation and agriculture that cause a lot of carbon and other greenhouse gases to go up into the air. But our dual mission also involves promoting local solutions to the climate crisis. And so that means standing behind and with communities and just sort of everyone collectively figuring out what we need to do about a situation.
And Jean Girth, you've been called the instigator of 350sandpoint.org. What is 350sandpoint.org?
We're a local chapter of 350.org, and 350.org is a national, international organization that Bill McKibben, who's well-known in the climate change world, that he started, I don't know how long ago, but quite a few years ago. And they are set up to really promote local chapters of 350. And as Helen was saying, and I was going to say this is where a lot of our overlap is between Sandpoint 350 Sandpoint and WERT is the local part of it. So our chapter is here to help promote local solutions, to be a networking site for people, and a support network, because truthfully, climate change is a pretty overwhelming topic, and I think we all need to stick together and support each other in whatever it is that we do. And I'm also very devoted to the tent idea. Everybody can come underneath the tent because we need every aspect of fighting climate change in order to make any difference. So we need to not fight among ourselves.
What does the 350 mean?
Oh, thank you. 350 is the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that scientists have determined is sustainable for human civilization. We're above 400 now.
Well, okay.
Yeah. Well, that's a happy note.
Yeah. Well, it's a wake-up call.
Yeah.
You know, we got to get busy here.
Yeah.
Is that 400 number globally or in specific areas, depending on what's going on there?
I think that's an interesting question, because the thing about climate change is that it's all global. That's global. That's air. So what we burn, you know, what China, if we export coal to China and they burn it, we're going to get it back. Mm-hmm. And what we use here is impacting everybody else in the rest of the world. So it's the ultimate in we are all one.
How'd you guys get hooked up with Tom Nielsen?
Well, we got an email out of the blue proposing a 350 concert, and we said, sure, let's do it in three different places. In Boise, where a lot of the folks are fighting natural gas drilling and extraction and processing and putting that on bomb trains and sending it down to Salt Lake City. And also in Moscow, where we've fought tar sands infrastructure coming through, heading up to Alberta. And here, of course, in Sandpoint, where the main fossil fuel issue are the coal and the oil trains coming through, heading to the West Coast.
I was going to ask about that. What is here in Sandpoint? What have you guys been doing, and what have your main causes been locally?
I will defer to Helen on that, because the most visible thing is the oil trains here. And then I'll talk more about the other things that we've done. But I think Sandpoint is a crossing ground. The funnel, that's right, the funnel. And the train people don't release, you know, and there's good reason for this, but they don't tell you how many trains are coming through here. But I imagine that most people have seen them coming mm-hmm. through.
And they're required by policy or law to notify the communities that they come through when they're carrying a load of Bakken crude, a million gallons or more. So it winds up being a unit train, like 110 cars.
Right, the mile-long train.
Yeah. They're required to notify.
The emergency responders, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's who it goes to. In Bonner County, it goes to Bob Howard at Emergency Management Services, and then he dispenses that information to agencies on a need-to-know basis, which when I was with the city of Sandpoint, we made sure we were on that distribution list I don't know that other municipalities did likewise, but we did because City of Sandpoint at that time had the only certified hazmat firefighters in this area. And I've heard since then that those firefighters let that expertise expire. Mm-hmm. That's something I think that needs to be followed up on. But anyway, so.
And Helen's been the organizer behind the events that are specific to the oil train.
Right, yeah. And each of those trains actually carries, best as I can figure, about 3 million gallons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's both Bakken crude, which is highly explosive, as we all know, but also tar sands crude that comes mm-hmm. in on the Union Pacific lines through Ponderay and then out along the ball fields on the west side of town.
Right.
And we saw from several fires that happened up in Ontario, even in the dead of winter, that tar sands oil is also very explosive because they mix it in with natural gas condensate and other, you know, volatile substances just to make it liquid enough to flow in and out of the trains. But then also, you know, there's coal trains going across the 4,800 foot bridge across Lake Ponderay. And if those, each coal car loses 1 pound of coal dust, you know, per car, per mile, then you can figure that's about 109 pounds of coal dust that are going into Lake Ponderay every single time that one of those trains goes over that bridge. And we've been trying to monitor as closely as possible what's going through just, and, you know, we've taught people how to monitor trains. We've had several workshops. We ask people to report what they see. And best as we can figure, just randomly spotting trains or, you know, sitting and doing other things and watching all day. There's about 2 coal trains and 2 oil trains going on the Burlington Northern Santa Fe rails over that lake bridge every single day.
Hmm. I was going to ask Carrie, turn to my co-host and just ask you curiosity. Do you know when you were with the city, do you know how often was it? Did you get many reports of these trains going through?
Yeah, there were of the unit trains. There were at the time I left the city between, and that was after the downturn in the oil industry. And so they were reducing the number of trains that were coming through. It was around 10 to 12 per week unit trains.
Wow.
Just of the Bakken crude. And that was just on the BNSF. The UP and the UP did not, I can't remember one time that we got notice from UP because they wouldn't run unit trains. They shortened them. So they didn't meet the notification requirement. I don't know if that was intentional or just happened to happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, there were 10 to 12. At one time, there were almost 20 mm-hmm. a week.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
The event at DeLuna's is this Sunday. You guys are going to be there?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We want to bring people in. We want to have them meet each other and network.
Yeah.
And have fun.
How long has the Sandpoint chapter of 350 been around, 350.org?
I guess we'll be coming up on a year in October. My motivation for getting some people together to do this was that there was going to be a demonstration in support of the COP21 agreement in Paris. So that was the, now I forget what COP stands for. But it was the
Conference of Parties.
Thank you. Conference of Parties. And this was the big global meeting about climate change. And I didn't want to drive to Spokane to do a demonstration. So we had our little demonstration here with about 50 people, I think. And so that was the kickoff to it.
Quite a turnout. Do you guys feel like you've had any effect locally thus far? Do you feel like you have an avenue that you're moving down, a road you're moving down towards some kind of progress, or?
I think it's all progress.
Yeah.
I mean, 350 Sandpoint wants to make it easy to get resources to learn about climate change. So we have a website where we've started to do that. I want to make it easy for people to network and the events that we've had, I think, have done some of that. It's slow. It's coming.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I just wanted to mention, too, was that, well, number one, 350 Sandpoint is not a 501c3, so we are political. And I think that's the niche, part of the niche that we're going to fill in this town, is that we don't have to abide by, you know, not lobbying people. So we're working with the candidates in this election to try to get them the information that they want and need about climate change. So we've had some response to that. I also don't want to compete with the other organizations in town, because we have some incredible organizations that are already working on climate change issues. So I always encourage people to be an active member of at least one of those groups, too. And Idaho Conservation League is probably the lead in climate change. They have a great website. I've been reading more of it lately. So there's a lot of information on there. But we also have... I can't even list them all. All of the environmental groups that are trying to conserve land, conserve water, protect water quality, that's all part of this too. We can't just focus on, I mean, we have to focus on keeping carbon out of the air, but we also have to focus on preserving what we've got, because we're in forced changes and the changes are happening now and we need to be prepared.
So you are politically active, the organization, and I guess I'll ask you to just speculate. I mean, is there anything that local officials, either municipal authorities or state authorities, can do, or is it mostly national?
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, I think most of this stuff is going to come from the ground up, because Washington is, you know, they're, you know, what Washington is.
It's dysfunctional.
Yeah, it's dysfunctional. Even if they are trying. But on the state level, there's already some things in place. The Clean Power Act. There's a Clean Power Plan. Mm-hmm. And that's an avenue where the politicians, I think, can go in and say, we want to make this a very strong plan. And this is the one about reducing carbon. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know this stuff really off the top of my head. But... This is a federal mandate to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in states. And so we have a plan in Idaho. But I think that there's a lot more that can be done. And recently I've been reading about what's happened in California. And California, it's working. I mean, in 2006, they started looking at ways and mandating that there be a decrease. And it's something like they had to reach... They're going to reach 1990 levels of carbon dioxide by a certain target date. So that's kind of how they're measuring it. And they're getting there, and it's working.
I think they just reduced it to 2020, too.
Right. They were successful enough that they've changed the timeline a little bit. So there's stuff out there. And then there's promoting alternative energy and really getting off of fossil fuel.
In a state like ours, where, well, for one thing, I mean, timber is still a main economic force, and where the legislature tends towards conservatism, and not necessarily conservationism, not necessarily the opposite either. Do you think? I mean, is the struggle harder for you guys, and do you have connections in the more conservative elements of our politics here?
I don't think so yet. I would like to, although no, the I'm going to forget his name. He's a Republican. He did respond to one of our emails that we sent out saying, "Hey, we're all in this together. We got to figure out how to do this together." And so I got a response from one Republican and a couple of Democrats. And that's not to fault that anybody. We're in the beginning stages, and we haven't established those relationships with people. And that's what needs to happen. We have to have relationships with everybody. You mentioned the timber industry, and this is one of those local concerns. I mean, with the drought and the wildfire and the bug infestations that we're getting now, our resource extraction industry around around wood is going to change. Schweitzer is going to be impacted by less snowpack. So there's, on that level also, there's a lot of local conversations that need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And are probably happening somewhere. I'm not the only one talking about this, I know.
There's a, I think it's Colorado-based organization that focuses on membership with ski resorts because of the, are you aware of that group?
I think, didn't ICL bring them here one year? Because one of my big wake-up calls about climate change was listening to somebody from Vail talking about how they're going to transition to non-snow events or to plan for non-snow events by 2050. They think that they're not, they were speculating that they were not going to have enough snowpack by then. So yeah. I don't know if that was that group.
Probably not the same group, because this one is really locked in with global warming and the impact on snow base and
specifically.
That kind of thing. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And they approached the city when we were, during my administration, when we were really actively involved in trying to impact the volume of Bakken crude coming through town. And so they reached out to us to partner with them in their efforts. But anyway,
you're listening to the KRFY Morning Show. We're in conversation with Gene Girth and Helen Yost, Gene of 350sandpoint.org and Helen of Wild Idaho Rising Tide. We haven't talked too much about the origins and of Wild Idaho Rising Tide, which is an interesting name, by the way. Where is that? How long have you guys been around?
It will be 6 years. On the very last day of March, we share a birthday with Cesar Chavez. We were sort of thrown into the fire in that there were huge megaloads, as we call them, of tar sands infrastructure that wanted to go up Highway 12 through a wild and scenic river corridor, national forest, the Nez Perce Reservation. And they were pushed back by very much grassroots activism, just the people along that highway pushing back against them. So I guess I wanted to interject earlier that we've had a lot of interaction with people that you might consider conservatives because, you know, things have invaded their landowner rights, their places that they cherish for hunting and fishing and such. Anyway, so when those loads could not go up Highway 12 because of it being challenged in the court system, and they were too high to normally go on interstates and such, they were 30 feet high, 200 feet long, weighing between 500,000 and 1,000,000 pounds, taking up the entirety of two-lane highways. Then they were chopped in half at great expense at the Port of Lewiston and sent up Highway 95, where the good people of Moscow turned out every single time they came through, 32 times in the course of 8 months, and protested on several occasions. We blockaded. There were in total only 13 arrests, a few people a couple times. And it wasn't just the protesting that got us arrested. We also were monitoring them to find them, you know, doing things wrong that we could challenge in court. So it was a big uproar. And I think our little town of Moscow was probably the first ever place in the United States to rise up against tar sands. And it was concurrent with the 1,200 arrests that were happening at the White House and the Keystone XL campaign, which pretty much overshadowed whatever was happening way out in Idaho. But the movement grew and grew. The Nez Perce rose up a few years later when the megaloads came up Highway 12 again. And just recently, there's been the Idaho Transportation has proposed new rules to try to circumvent federally mandated mediation between the tribe and Idaho Rivers United and the Forest Service, who many entities say should have authority over these loads going through a wild and scenic river corridor and a national forest. There's been rules proposed recently in hearings. Actually, the deadline for comment on these rules put forth by ITD, the Idaho Transportation Department, is October 14th. If anyone wants to check out our website, wildidahorisingtide.org, and comment on that. But then we also, very early on, because of the oil and gas drilling down in Payette County that started in 2010, were drawn into that whole situation. We still remain active in pushing back there. There'll be another state oil and gas lease auction on October 19th, and we're calling for protests on that as well. We haven't put out an announcement yet. And then, of course, we're presently stationed in Sandpoint because we're hoping the community will turn out more and more in direct actions against fossil fuels in this community. We've been pretty successful throughout the summer. There was a protest when there were nationwide protests against oil trains on the anniversary of the Lac-Mégantic disaster, which killed 47 people in a Quebec town when an oil train blew up there. And then there was good turnout for the Standing Rock Solidarity protest. And quite frankly, our monitoring, we believe, has helped two recent blockages of BNSF tracks in Spokane of oil and coal trains, in that we report every time we see an oil and coal train coming through, and they're only 75 miles down track. So they're able to use that information. So we've had some successes. There was also a kayaktivist event on the same day as the Lummi Totem Pole came through, and people turned out for that as well, just to protest around the rail bridge. So we're really grateful for the Sandpoint community rising up, as they have been little by little, and we hope for more of the same.
Kayaktivist. That's a nice little play on words there. The organization is Wild Idaho Rising Tide, referring, I'm guessing, to not rising tides here in this state, but around the world.
Right. Yeah. It's an international movement. The Rising Tide groups are just sort of, I guess, it's sort of modeled after Earth First, in that it's non-hierarchical, it's horizontal organizing, it's just people jumping in and doing whatever they need to do in sort of a disorganized fashion. But that's because of security concerns. I mean, we've been approached by the FBI even just because they're worried about our organizing, although we've been, you know, completely transparent about everything that we do. And we, you know, look to involve the community as much as possible.
You mentioned some of the events that you've got coming up, some things that you'll be involved in. How about you, Gene? How about you, Gene? 350sandpoint.org? Other events?
We're going to think about it after the concert.
Yeah.
It's taken a big effort, but we will have more. We have a website. We're on Facebook. And I want to keep trying to keep up the momentum. And can I just point out too, because I know I said this a lot in my head, was when people start talking about stopping the pipeline, stopping the trains, stopping all of this fossil fuel, it's like, well, I use oil in my car, I use gas in my car. You know, we have not transitioned to a fossil-free economy yet, but the amount of fossil fuel that is above ground right now, if it were burned, we would skyrocket through that two degree cap that the Paris Accords came up with. So we really have enough fossil fuel now. And if we burn everything that's there, we're going to be in more trouble than we are. So it's a hard thing to stop. I know people have vested interests in this. It's a big industry, and it's not going to just throw up its hands and say, oh yeah, let's develop solar. But I think it does bring that to light to people when you just say enough.
I'd like to comment and compliment on the when the totem came through town. That was a really meaningful event. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that was very inspiring to people too. And just a little aside there and a compliment on something that I think is a successful technique to educate and inspire.
Will you fill me in on that? I remember reading about it a little bit, but I'm not too aware of what that was.
Well, it was in cooperation with ICL, uh-huh. I think. And I was out of town, so I didn't go. So yeah. I'll defer.
And Lake Pondere Waterkeeper The city of Sandpoint was also, they were all co-sponsors. Essentially, it was the fourth totem pole that the Lummi Nation House of Tears carvers have put together. Very beautiful, very colorful. And they have taken these totem poles on road trips, specifically to frontline communities, both indigenous and otherwise, all across the Northwest on their way to the final place that they raise the pole, which is usually a community that is very sort of, I guess, saliently on the front lines of fighting a particular situation. So one totem pole ended up with the Beaver Lake Cree up in Alberta, who are fighting tar sands. One ended up on the Cheyenne Reservation in Wyoming, who are fighting coal. And there's a couple others. One ended up in the Vancouver area, where they're fighting tar sands pipelines coming out to the coast and big giant tankers endangering their waterways and their subsistence lifestyles. This last one ended up in, now I'm forgetting the name of the town. It's a town up in Ontario that holds the largest population of Indigenous people in all of Canada. And it's also an area that has just an intensive amount of industrialization, a lot of chemical and oil refineries, and just a lot of pollution. And the people there are really suffering because of it. So that's where this particular pole went. But they also made a stop through Standing Rock, because there's such a conglomeration of Indigenous resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline happening there in North Dakota at the confluence of the Cannonball and Missouri Rivers. 200 nations have stood behind those folks there in North Dakota, Standing Rock Sioux, who are fighting that pipeline. So they made a stop there as well. And the main speaker with this totem pole journey, Jule James, he's very empowering, and he says things that, you know, that need to be said by Indigenous people towards the rest of the population. So
we are running short on time here, so we're going to say good morning to Carrie. So long.
Hi.
Enjoy your day.
Nice meeting you. Can we give just the details?
I was going to say that. Yeah, okay. Let's do that one more time. And any other final thoughts you have? You want to get out there?
Please join us on Sunday. It should be fun. Tom Nielsen at DeLuna's Cafe. If you want to come for dinner, please call DeLuna's at 263-0846 to get a reservation.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's the information about the concert. Thank you, Gene and Helen, for joining us this morning on The Morning Show. And enjoy that concert. And thanks to Tom for calling in yesterday and talking to me earlier in the show.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Helen. I'm going to run through our other upcoming events for the weekend in my remaining minute and a half on the program. On the air, you guys can step out or stick around or whatever you want to do. You are listening, of course, to The Morning Show on 88.5 KRFY every single Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, ongoing this month and until November, until the election, the first Tuesday in November. We do have the Local Decision 2016 series continuing. Join the KRFY Morning Show hosts these Wednesdays, every single Wednesday, for interviews with candidates running for local office. In addition, you can catch rebroadcasts of that show on Fridays at 5 o'clock during your drive home from work, if you like. We will be postponing Economic Update, which usually airs at that time, will be postponed until 6 o'clock. We're shuffling the schedule around just a little bit so we can make sure that all the voters in our area get their chance to hear what's going on. Also, you can, if you don't have a chance to listen on the radio, you can go to our website, krfy.org, catch the podcast. Going on this weekend, in addition to the Tom Nielsen concert on Sunday, you can go ahead and check out, among other things, a showing of the movie Snowden at the Panada Theater. That's going on tonight and on Saturday and on Sunday. Showtimes are at 7:30 p.m., 3:30 p.m. on Saturday, and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, and 3:30 p.m. just the matinee on Sunday. Go to panada.org for more information about that. Tomorrow night, live music at the Poor Authority with Marty Perrin and Doug Bond. Live music at the Winery with Wayne Worthen on the 7th. That's tomorrow night. And the Radical Reels Tour is back. The best high adrenaline films from the Banff Mountain Film Festival are coming to Sandpoint's Panada Theater. That's at 7:30 p.m. on the 7th, tomorrow night. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. There is plenty more going on. I do want to mention the plein air paint out. Whether you've never picked up a brush in your life or you've been painting for years, the Scotchman Peaks 9th Annual Plein Air Paint Out returns this fall on the 8th, that's Saturday. The format changes a bit from the past. You will be provided with a canvas and asked to create the best, most beautiful postcard possible. Painting will be done from dawn until dusk. It's all out of doors this Saturday. You can meet at the Outskirts Gallery, 620 Wellington Place in Hope. Register with Callie Thurman at the Outskirts by calling 264-5696 or email callythurman@gmail.com or visit the Scotchman Peaks website for more information about that. Oh, there's a quilting show out at the fairgrounds. There's Indie Author Day at the Sandpoint Library. But you're going to have to check all that out online. Go to sandpointonline.com for more information because we are fresh out of time. Thanks for listening to the morning show. Stay tuned for Bird Note and then Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on 88.5 KRFY Ponderay.